and that it might be 1,000 more before she could go home. 4. The air was as sweet as she had hoped, perhaps even sweeter, and for a moment she only stood on the stoop, breathing it in, trying to cleanse her lungs and her mind. After 5 good breaths, she got herself in motion. Around the side of the house she went. But it was the wrong side, it seemed, for there was no woodpile here. There was a narrow excuse for a window, however, half buried in some tough and unlovely creeper. It was toward the back of the hut, and must look in on the old woman's sleeping closet. "Don't look in there. Whatever she's got under her bed isn't your business, and if she were to catch you..." She went to the window despite these admonitions and peeked in. It was unlikely that Rhea would have seen Susan's face through the dense overgrowth of pig ivy, even if the old besom had been looking in that direction, and she wasn't. She was on her knees, the drawstring bag caught in her teeth, reaching under the bed. She brought out a box and opened its lid, which was already ajar. Her face was flooded with soft pink radiance, and Susan gasped. For one moment it was the face of a young girl, but one filled with cruelty as well as youth, the face of a self-willed child determined to learn all the wrong things for all the wrong reasons. The face of the girl this hag once had been, mayhap. The light appeared to be coming from some sort of glass ball. The old woman looked at it for several moments, her eyes wide and fascinated. Her lips moved as if she were speaking to it, or perhaps even singing to it. The little bag Susan had brought from town, its strings still clamped in the hag's mouth, bobbed up and down as she spoke. Then, with what appeared to be great effort of will, she closed the box, cutting off the rosy light. Susan found herself relieved. There was something about it she didn't like. The old woman cupped one hand over the silver lock in the middle of the lid, and a brief scarlet light spiked out from between her fingers. All this with the drawstring bag still hanging from her mouth. Then she put the box on the bed, knelt, and began running her hands over the dirt just beneath the bed's edge. Although she touched only with her palms, lines appeared as if she had used a drawing tool. These lines darkened, becoming what looked like grooves. "The wood, Susan! Get the wood before she wakes up to how long you've been gone, for your father's sake!" Susan pulled the skirt of her dress all the way up to her waist. She did not want the old woman to see dirt or leaves on her clothing when she came back inside, did not want to answer the questions the sight of such smuts might provoke, and crawled beneath the window with her white cotton drawers flashing in the moonlight. Once she was past, she got to her feet again and hurried quietly around to the far side of the hut. Here she found the woodpile under an old, moldy-smelling hide. She took 6 good-sized chunks and walked back toward the front of the house with them in her arms. When she entered, turning sideways to get her load through the doorway without dropping any, the old woman was back in the main room, staring moodily into the fireplace, where there was now little more than embers. Of the drawstring bag there was no sign.
"Took you long enough, missy," Rhea said.
She continued to look into the fireplace as if Susan were of no account, but one foot tapped below the dirty hem of her dress, and her eyebrows were drawn together. Susan crossed the room, peering over the load of wood in her arms as well as she could while she walked. It wouldn't surprise her a bit to spy the cat lurking near, hoping to trip her up.
"I saw a spider," she said. "I flapped my apron at it to make it run away. I hate the look of 'em, so I do."
"You'll see something you like the look of even less soon enough," Rhea said, grinning her peculiar one-sided grin. "Out of old Thorin's nightshirt it'll come, stiff as a stick and red as rhubarb. Hold a minute, girl, ye gods. You've brought enough for a fair day bonfire."
Rhea took 2 fat logs from Susan's pile and tossed them indifferently onto the coals. Embers spiraled up the dark and faintly roaring shaft of the chimney.
"There. You've scattered what's left of your fire, you silly old thing, and we'll likely have to rekindle the whole mess," Susan thought.
Then Rhea reached into the fireplace with one splayed hand, spoke a guttural word, and the logs blazed up as if soaked in oil.
"Put the rest over there," she said, pointing at the wood box. "And mind you not be a scatterbug, missy."
What and dirty, all this neat, Susan thought. She bit the insides of her cheeks to kill the smile that wanted to rise on her mouth. Rhea might have sensed it, however. When Susan straightened again, the old woman was looking at her with a dour, knowing expression.
"All right, mistress. Let's do our business and have it done. You know why you're here?"
"I am here at Mayor Thorin's wish," Susan repeated, knowing that was no real answer.
She was frightened now, more frightened than when she had looked through the window and seen the old woman crooning to the glass ball.
"His wife has come barren to the end of her courses. He wishes to have a son, before he is also unable to..."
"Pish, tush! Spare me the codswallop and pretty words. He wants tits and ass that don't squish in his hands, and a box that'll grip what he pushes. If he's still man enough to push it, that is. If a son come of it, aye, fine, he'll give it over to you to keep and raise until it's old enough to school, and after that you'll see it no more. If it's a daughter, he'll likely take it from you and give it to his new man, the one with the girl's hair and the limp, to drown in the nearest cattle walla."
Susan stared at her, shocked out of all measure. The old woman saw the look and laughed.
"Don't like the sound of the truth, do you? Few do, missy. But that's neither here nor there. Your auntie was ever a trig one, and she'll have done all right out of Thorin and Thorin's treasury. What gold you see of it's none of mine, and won't be none of yours either if you don't watch sharp. He, take off that dress."
"I won't," was what rose to her lips. But what then?
To be turned out of this hut, and to be turned out pretty much as she had come, and not as a lizard or a hopping toad, would probably be the best luck she could hope for, and sent west as she was now, without even the 2 gold coins she'd brought up here. And that was only the small half of it. The large was that she had given her word. At first she had resisted, but when Aunt Cord had invoked her father's name, she had given in, as she always did. Really, she had no choice. And when there was no choice, hesitation was ever a fault. She brushed the front of her apron, to which small bits of bark now clung, then untied it and took it off. She folded it, laid it on a small, grimy hassock near the hearth, and unbuttoned her dress to the waist. She shivered it from her shoulders and stepped out. She folded it and laid it atop the apron, trying not to mind the greedy way Rhea of Koos was staring at her in the firelight. The cat came sashaying across the floor, grotesque extra legs bobbling, and sat at Rhea's feet. Outside, the wind gusted. It was warm on the hearth, but Susan was cold just the same, as if that wind had gotten inside her somehow.
"Hurry, girl, for your father's sake!"
Susan pulled her shift over her head, folded it atop the dress, then stood in only her drawers, with her arms folded over her bosom. The fire painted warm orange highlights along her thighs, black circles of shadow in the tender folds behind her knees.
"And still she's not naked," the old crow laughed. "Ain't we, la-dee-da? Aye, we are very fine. Take off those drawers, mistress, and stand as you slid from your mother. Although you had not so many goodies as to interest the likes of Hart Thorin then, did ye? He."
Feeling caught in a nightmare, Susan did as she was bid. With her mound and bush uncovered, her crossed arms seemed foolish. She lowered them to her sides.
"No wonder he wants ye," the old woman said. "'Tis beautiful ye are, and true. Is she not, musty?"
The cat wowed.
"There's dirt on your knees," Rhea said suddenly. "How came it there?"
Susan felt a moment of awful panic. She had lifted her skirts to crawl beneath the hag's window and hung herself by doing it. Then an answer rose to her lips, and she spoke it calmly enough.
"When I came inside of your hut, I grew fearful. I knelt to pray and raised my skirt so as not to soil it."
"I'm touched. To want a clean dress for the likes of me. How good you are. Don't you agree, musty?"
The cat wowed, then began to lick one of its forepaws.
"Get on with it," Susan said. "You've been paid, and I'll obey, but stop teasing and have done."
"You know what it is I have to do, mistress."
"I don't," Susan said.
The tears were close again, burning the backs of her eyes, but she would not let them fall. Would not.
"I have an idea, but when I asked Aunt Cord if I was right, she said that you'd take care of my education in that regard."
"Wouldn't dirty her mouth with the words, would she? Well, that's all right. Your Aunt Rhea's not too nice to say what your Aunt Cordelia won't. I'm to make sure that you're physically and spiritually intact, Missy. Proven honesty is what the old ones called it, and it's good enough name, so it is. Step to me."
Susan took two reluctant steps forward so that her bare toes were almost touching the old woman's slippers and her bare breasts were almost touching the old woman's dress.
"If a devil or demon has polluted your spirit, such a thing as might taint the child you'll likely bear, it leaves a mark behind. Most often it's a suck mark or a lover's bite, but there's others. Open your mouth."
Susan did, and when the old woman bent closer, the reek of her was so strong that the girl's stomach clenched. She held her breath, praying this would be over soon.
"Run out your tongue."
Susan ran out her tongue.
"Now send your breezes into my face."
Susan exhaled her held breath. Rhea breathed it in, and then, mercifully, pulled her head away a little. She had been close enough for Susan to see the lice hopping in her hair.
"Sweet enough," the old woman said. "Ah, good's a meal. Now turn around."
Susan did, and felt the old witch's fingers trail down her back and to her buttocks. Their tips were cold as mud.
"Bend over and spread your cheeks, missy. Be not shy. Rhea's seen more than one paltry in her time."
Face flushing, she could feel the beat of her heart in the center of her forehead and in the hollows of her temples, Susan did as told. And then she felt one of those corpse-like fingers prod its way into her anus. Susan bit her lips to keep from screaming. The invasion was mercifully short, but there would be another, Susan feared.
"Turn around."
She turned. The old woman passed her hands over Susan's breast, flicked lightly at the nipples with her thumbs, then examined the undersides carefully. Rhea slipped a finger into the cup of the girl's navel, then hitched up her own skirt and dropped to her knees with a grunt of effort. She passed her hands down Susan's legs, first front, then back. She seemed to take special pains with the area just below the calves, where the tendons ran.
"Lift your right foot, girl."
Susan did, and uttered a nervous, screamy laugh as Rhea ran a thumbnail down her instep to her heel. The old woman parted her toes, looking between each pair. After this process had been repeated with the other foot, the old woman, still on her knees, said,
"You know what comes next."
"I..."
The word came out of her in a little trembling rush.
"Hold you still, missy. All else is well, clean as a willow strip you are. But now we've come to the cozy nook that's all Thorn cares for. We've come to where honesty must really be proved. So hold you still."
Susan closed her eyes and thought of horses running along the drop. Nominally, they were the barony's horse, overlooked by Rhymer, Thorin's chancellor, and the barony's minister of inventory. But the horses didn't know that. They thought they were free, and if you were free in your mind, what else mattered?
"Let me be free in my mind, as free as the horses along the drop, and don't let her hurt me. Please don't let her hurt me. And if she does, please help me to bear it in decent silence."
Cold fingers parted the downy hair below her navel. There was a pause, and then two cold fingers slipped inside her. There was pain, but only a moment of it, and not bad. She'd hurt herself worse, stubbing her toe or barking her shin on the way to the privy in the middle of the night. The humiliation was the bad part, and the revulsion of Rhea's ancient touch.
"Cock tight you are," Rhea cried. "Good as ever was. But Thorin'll see to that, so he will. As for you, my girl, I'll tell you a secret. Your prissy aunt, with her long nose and tight purse and little goosebump tits, never knew. Even a girl who's intact don't need to lack for a shiver now and then, if she knows how.
The hag's withdrawing fingers closed gently around the little nubbin of flesh at the head of Susan's cleft. For one terrible second, Susan thought they would pinch that sensitive place, which sometimes made her draw in a breath if it rubbed just so against the pommel of her saddle when she was riding. But instead the fingers caressed, then pressed, and the girl was horrified to feel a heat which was far from unpleasant kindle in her belly.
"Like a little bud of silk," the old woman crooned, and her meddling fingers moved faster.
Susan felt her hips sway forward, as if with a mind and life of their own, and then she thought of the old woman's greedy, self-willed face, pink as the face of a whore by gaslight as it hung over the open box. She thought of the way the drawstring bag with the gold pieces in it had hung from the wrinkled mouth like some disgorged piece of flesh. And the heat she felt was gone. She drew back, trembling, her arms and belly and breasts breaking out in goose flesh.
"You've finished what you were paid to do," Susan said.
Her voice was dry and harsh. Rhea's face knotted.
"You'll not tell me I know, yes, or maybe, impudent stripling of a girl. I know when I'm done. I, Rhea, the weirding of Coos.
And be still, and be on your feet before I kick you into the fire, unnatural thing."
The old woman's lips wriggled back from her few remaining teeth in a dog-like sneer, and now, Susan realized, she and the witch-woman were back where they had been at the start, ready to claw each other's eyes out.
"Raise hand or foot to me, you impudent cunt, and what leaves my house will leave handless, footless, and blind of eye."
"I do not doubt much you could do it, but Thorin should be vexed," Susan said.
It was the first time in her life she had ever invoked a man's name for protection. Realizing this made her feel ashamed, small, somehow. She didn't know why that should be, especially since she had agreed to sleep in his bed and bear his child. But it was. The old woman stared, her seamed face working until it folded into a parody of a smile that was worse than her snarl. Puffing and pulling at the arm of her chair, Rhea got to her feet. As she did, Susan quickly began to dress.
"Aye, vexed he would be. Perhaps you know best after all, missy. I've had a strange night, and it's wakened parts of me better left to sleep. Anything else that might have happened? Take it as a compliment to your youth and purity, and to your beauty as well. Ah, you're a beautiful thing, and there's no doubt in it. Your hair, now, when you let it down, as you will for Thorin, I wot, when you lay with him, it glows like the sun, doesn't it?"
Susan did not want to force the old hag out of her posturing, but she didn't want to encourage these fawning compliments either. Not when she could still see the hate in Rhea's rheumy eyes, not when she could feel the old woman's touch still crawling like beetles on her skin. She said nothing, only stepped into her dress, set it on her shoulders, and began to button up the front. Rhea perhaps understood the run of her thoughts, for the smile dropped off her mouth and her manner grew businesslike. Susan found this a great relief.
"Well, never mind it. You've proved honest. You may dress yourself and go. But not a word of what passed between us to Thorin, mind ye. Words between women need trouble no man's ear, especially one as great as he."
Yet at this, Rhea could not forbear a certain spasming sneer. Susan didn't know if the old woman was aware of it or not.
"Are we agreed?"
"Anything, anything, just as long as I can be out of here and away. You declare me proved?"
"Aye, Susan, daughter of Patrick, so I do. But it's not what I say that matters. Now, wait. Somewhere here."
She scrabbled along the mantle, pushing stubs of candles stuck on cracked saucers this way and that, lifting first a kerosene lantern and then a battery flashlight, looking fixedly for a moment at a drawing of a young boy and then putting it aside.
Where are here?
She snatched up a pad of paper with a sooty cover, Sitgo stamped on it in ancient gold letters, and a stub of pencil. She paged almost to the end of the pad before finding a blank sheet. On it she scrawled something, then tore the sheet off the spiral of wire at the top of the pad. She held the sheet out to Susan, who took it and looked at it. Scrawled there was a word she did not understand at first.
Honest.
Below it was a symbol.
"What's this?"
she asked, tapping the little stick figure drawing.
"Rhea, her mark. Known for 6 baronies around, it is, and can't be copied. Show that paper to your aunt, then to Thorin. If your aunt wants to take it and show it to Thorin herself, I know her easy in her bossy ways. Tell her no. Rhea says no. She's not to have the keeping of it."
"And if Thorin wants it?"
Rhea shrugged dismissively.
"Let him keep it, or burn it, or wipe his bum with it, for all of me. It's nothing to you either, for you knew you were honest all along, so you did. True?"
Susan nodded. Once, walking home after a dance, she had let a boy slip his hand inside her shirt for a moment or two. But what of that? She was honest, and in more ways than this nasty creature meant.
"But don't lose that paper. Unless she'd see me again, that is, and go through the same business a second time."
"Gods perish even the thought," Susan thought, and managed not to shudder. She put the paper in her pocket where the drawstring bag had been.
"Now come to the door, missy."
She looked as if she wanted to grasp Susan's arm, then thought better of it. The two of them walked side by side to the door, not touching in such a careful way that it made them look awkward. Once there, Rhea did grip Susan's arm. Then, with her other hand, she pointed to the bright silver disc hanging over the top of the coos.
"The kissing moon," Rhea said. "'Tis midsummer."
"Yes."
"Tell Thorin he's not to have you in his bed, or in a haystack, or on the scullery floor, or anywhere else, until demon moon rises full in the sky."
"Not until reaping?"
That was 3 months. A lifetime, it seemed to her. Susan tried not to show her delight at this reprieve. She'd thought Thorin would put an end to her virginity by moonrise the next night. She wasn't blind to the way he looked at her. Rhea, meanwhile, was looking at the moon, seeming to calculate. Her hand went to the long tail of Susan's hair and stroked it. Susan bore this as well as she could, and just when she felt she could bear it no longer, Rhea dropped her hand back to her side and nodded.
"Aye, not just reaping, but true findanio, fair knight, tell him. Say that he may have you after the bonfire, you understand?"
"True findanio, yes."
She could barely contain her joy.
"When the fire in Green Heart burns low, and the last of the red-handed men are ashes," Rhea said. "Then, and not until then, you must tell him so."
"I will."
The hand came out and began to stroke her hair again. Susan bore it. After such good news, she thought, it would have been mean-spirited to do otherwise.
"The time between now and reaping you will use to meditate and to gather your forces to produce the male child the mare wants, or mayhap just to ride along the drop and gather the last flowers of your maidenhood. Do you understand?"
"Yes." She dropped a curtsy. "Thank you, Si."
Rhea waved this off as if it were a flattery.
"Speak not of what passed between us, mind. 'Tis no one's affair but our own."
"I won't. And our business is done?"
"Well, mayhap there's one more small thing."
Rhea smiled to show it was indeed small, then raised her left hand in front of Susan's eyes, with 3 fingers together and 1 apart. Glimmering in the fork between was a silver medallion, seemingly produced from nowhere. The girl's eyes fastened on it at once. until Rhea spoke a single guttural word, that was. Then they closed. Five. Rhea looked at the girl who stood asleep on her stoop in the moonlight. As she replaced the medallion within her sleeve, her fingers were old and bunchy, but they moved dexterously enough when it was required. Oh, aye, the business-like expression fell from her face and was replaced by a look of squint-eyed fury.
Kick me into the fire, would you, you troll, tattle to Thorin?
But her threats and impudence weren't the worst. The worst had been the expression of revulsion on her face when she had pulled back from Rhea's touch. Too good for Rhea, she was, and thought herself too good for Thorin as well, no doubt. She was 16 years' worth of fine blonde hair hanging down from her head, hair Thorin no doubt dreamed of plunging his hands into, even as he plunged and reared and plowed down below. She couldn't hurt the girl, much as she wanted to and much as the girl deserved it. If nothing else, Thorin might take the glass ball away from her, and Rhea couldn't bear that, not yet anyway. So she could not hurt the girl. But she could do something that would spoil his pleasure in her, at least for a while. Rhea leaned close to the girl, grasped the long braid which lay down her back, and began to slip it through her fist, enjoying its silky smoothness.
"Susan," she whispered. "Do you hear me, Susan, daughter of Patrick?"
"Yes." The eyes did not open.
"Then listen."
The light of the kissing moon fell on Rhea's face and turned it into a silver skull.
"Listen to me well, and remember. Remember in the deep cave where your waking mind never goes."
She pulled the braid through her hand again and again, silky and smooth, like the little bud between her legs.
"Remember," the girl in the doorway said.
"Aye, there's something you'll do after he takes your virginity. You'll do it right away without even thinking about it. Now listen to me, Susan, daughter of Patrick, and hear me very well."
Still stroking the girl's hair, Rhea put her wrinkled lips to the smooth cup of Susan's ear and whispered in the moonlight. Chapter 3. A Meeting on the Road. 1. She had never in her life had such a strange night, and it was probably not surprising that she didn't hear the rider approaching from behind until he was almost upon her. The thing that troubled her most as she made her way back toward town was her new understanding of the compact she had made. It was good to have a reprieve, months yet before she would have to live up to her end of the bargain. But a reprieve didn't change the basic fact. When the demon moon was full, she would lose her virginity to Mayor Thorin, a skinny, twitchy man with fluffy white hair rising like a cloud around the bald spot on top of his head, a man whose wife regarded him with a certain weary sadness that was painful to look at. Hart Thorin was a man who laughed uproariously when a company of players put on an entertainment involving head-knocking or pretend-punching or rotten fruit-throwing, but who only looked puzzled at a story which was pathetic or tragical. A knuckle-cracker, a back-slapper, a dinner-table belcher, a man who had a way of looking anxiously toward his chancellor at almost every other word, as if to make sure he hadn't offended Rhymer in some way. Susan had observed all these things often. Her father had for years been in charge of the barony's horse, and had gone to Seafront often on business. Many times he had taken his much-loved daughter with him. Oh, she had seen a lot of Hart Thorin over the years, and he had seen a lot of her as well. Too much, mayhap. For what now seemed the most important fact about him was that he was almost 50 years older than the girl who would perhaps bear his son. She had made the bargain lightly enough. No, Not lightly, that was being unfair to herself. But she had lost little sleep over it, that much was true. She had thought, after listening to all Aunt Cord's arguments, "Well, it's little enough, really, to have the indenture off the lands, to finally own our little piece of the drop, in fact as well as in tradition, to actually have papers, one in our house and one in Reimer's files, saying it's ours. Aye, and to have horses again. Only three, 'tis true, but that's three more than we have now, and against that, to lie with him a time or two, and to bear a child, which millions of women have done before me with no harm. 'Tis not, after all, a mutant or a leper I'm being asked to partner with, but just an old man with noisy knuckles. 'Tis not forever, and as Aunt Cord says, I may still marry, if time and God decree. I should not be the first woman to come to her husband's bed as a mother. And does it make me a whore to do such? The law says not. But never mind that. My heart's law is what matters. And my heart says that if I may gain the land that was my dad's, and three horses to run on it by being such, then it's a whore I'll be." There was something else. Aunt Cord had capitalized rather ruthlessly, Susan now saw, on a child's innocence. It was the baby, Aunt Cord had harped on, the cunning little baby she would have. Aunt Cord had known that Susan, the dolls of her childhood put aside not all that long ago, would love the idea of her own baby, a little living doll to dress and feed and sleep with in the heat of the afternoon. What Cordelia had ignored, perhaps she's too innocent even to have considered it, Susan thought, but didn't quite believe, was what the hag woman had made brutally clear to her this evening. Thorin wanted more than a child.
"He wants tits and ass that don't squish in his hands, and a box that'll grip what he pushes."
Just thinking of those words made her face throb as she walked through the post-moonset dark toward town. No high-spirited running this time, no singing either. She had agreed with vague thoughts of how managed livestock mated. They were allowed to go at it until the seed took, then separated again. But now she knew that Thorin might want her again and again, probably would want her again and again, and common law, going back like iron for 200 generations, said that he could continue to lie with her until she who had proved the consort honest should prove her honestly with child as well. And that child honest in and of itself, not that was a mutant aberration. Susan had made discreet inquiries and knew that this second proving usually came around the fourth month of pregnancy, around the time she would begin to show, even with her clothes on. It would be up to Rhea to make the judgment, and Rhea didn't like her. Now that it was too late, now that she had accepted the compact formally tendered by the Chancellor, now that she had been proved honest by yon strange bitch, she rued the bargain. Mostly what she thought of was how Thorin would look with his pants off, his legs white and skinny like the legs of a stork, and how as they lay together she would hear his long bones crackling, knees and back and elbows and neck. And knuckles, don't forget his knuckles. Yes, big old man's knuckles with hair growing out of them. Susan chuckled at the thought, it was that comical. But at the same time a warm tear ran unnoticed from the corner of one eye and tracked down her cheek. She wiped it away without knowing it, any more than she heard the clip-clop of approaching hoofs in the soft road dust. Her mind was still far away, returning to the odd thing she had seen through the old woman's bedroom window. The soft but somehow unpleasant light coming from the pink globe, the hypnotized way the hag had been looking down at it. When Susan at last heard the approaching horse, her first alarmed thought was that she must get into the copse of trees she was currently passing and hide. The chances of anyone above board being on the road this late seemed small to her, especially now that such bad times had come to Midworld. But it was too late for that. The ditch, then, and sprawled flat. With the moon down, there was at least a chance that whoever it was would pass without... But before she could even begin in that direction, the rider who had sneaked up behind her while she was thinking her long and rueful thoughts had hailed her. "Good even, lady, and may your days be long upon the earth." She turned, thinking, what if it's one of the new men always lounging about Mayor's house or in the Traveler's Rest? Not the oldest one, the voice isn't wavery like his, but maybe one of the others. It could be the one they called De Pape. "Good even," she heard herself saying to the man-shape on the tall horse, "may yours be long also." Her voice didn't tremble, not that she could hear. She didn't think it was Deep Pape, or the one named Reynolds, either. The only thing she could tell about the fellow for sure was that he wore a flat-brimmed hat, the sort she associated with men of the inner baronies, back when travel between east and west had been more common than it was now. Back before John Farson came, the good man, and the bloodletting began. As the stranger came up beside her, she forgave herself a little for not hearing him approach. There was no buckle or bell on his gear that she could see, and everything was tied down so as not to snap or flap. It was almost the rig of an outlaw, or a harrier. She had the idea that Jonas, he of the wavery voice, and his two friends might have been both in other times and other climes. Or even a gunslinger. But this man bore no guns, unless they were hidden. A bow on the pommel of his saddle, and what looked like a lance in a scabbard, that was all. And there had never, she reckoned, been a gunslinger as young as this. He clucked side-mouth at the horse, just as her dad had always done, and she herself, of course, and it stopped at once. As he swung one leg over his saddle, lifting it high and with unconscious grace, Susan said, "Nay, nay, don't trouble yourself, stranger, but go as you would." If he heard the alarm in her voice, he paid no heed to it. He slipped off the horse, not bothering with the tied-down stirrup, and landed neatly in front of her, the dust of the road puffing about his square-toed boots. By starlight she saw that he was young indeed, close to her own age, on one side or the other. His clothes were those of a working cowboy, although new. "Will Dearborn at your service," he said, then doffed his hat, extended a foot on one boot heel, and bowed as they did in the inner baronies. Such absurd courtliness out here in the middle of nowhere, with the acrid smell of the oil patch on the edge of town already in her nostrils, startled her out of her fear and into a laugh. She thought it would likely offend him, but he smiled instead. A good smile, honest and artless, its inner part lined with even teeth. She dropped him a little curtsy, holding out one side of her dress. "Susan Delgado, at yours." He tapped his throat thrice with his right hand. "Thank'ee, si, Susan Delgado. We're well met, I hope. I didn't mean to startle you."
"You did, a little."
"Yes, I thought I had. I'm sorry."
"Yes, not I, but yes. A young man from the inner baronies, by the sound."
She looked at him with new interest.
"Nay, you need not apologize, for I was deep in my own thoughts," she said. "I'd been to see a friend, and hadn't realized how much time had passed until I saw the moon was down. If you stopped out of concern, I thank you, stranger, but you may be on your way as I would be on mine. It's only to the edge of the village I go. Hambury, it's close now."
"Pretty speech and lovely sentiments," he answered with a grin. "But it's late, you're alone, and I think we may as well pass on together. You ride, Si?"
"Yes, but really step over and meet my friend Rusher, then. He shall carry you the last 2 miles. He's gelded, Si, and gentle."
She looked at Will Dearborn with a mixture of amusement and irritation. The thought which crossed her mind was, if he calls me Si again, as though I were a schoolteacher or his doddery old great-aunt, I'm going to take off this stupid apron and swat him with it.
I never minded a bit of temper in a horse docile enough to wear a saddle. Until his death, my father managed the mayor's horses, and the mayor in these parts is also guard of barony. I've ridden my whole life.
She thought he might apologize, perhaps even stutter, but he only nodded with a calm thoughtfulness that she rather liked. "Then step to the stirrup, my lady. I'll walk beside and trouble you with no conversation if you'd rather not have it. It's late, and talk palls after moonset, some say." She shook her head, softening her refusal with a smile.
"Nay, I thank you for your kindness. But it would not be well, mayhap, for me to be seen riding a strange young man's horse at 11 o'clock. Lemon juice won't take the stain out of a lady's reputation the way it will out of a shirt-waist, you know."
"There's no one out here to see you," the young man said, in a maddeningly reasonable voice. "And that you're tired, I can tell."
Come, Sai, please don't call me that. It makes me feel as ancient as a...
She hesitated for a brief moment, rethinking the word which, that first came to her mind,
as an old woman.
Miss Delgado, then. Are you sure you won't ride?
Sure as can be. I'd not ride cross-saddle in a dress in any case, Mr. Dearborn, not even if you were my own brother. 'Twouldn't be proper.
He stood in the stirrup himself, reached over to the far side of his saddle. Rusher stood docilely enough at this, only flicking his ears, which Susan would have been happy to flick herself had she been Rusher, they were that beautiful, and stepped back down with a rolled garment in his hands. It was tied with a rawhide hank. She thought it was a poncho. "You may spread this over your lap and legs, like a duster," he said. "There's quite enough of it for decorum's sake. It was my father's, and he's taller than me." He looked off toward the western hills for a moment, and she saw he was handsome, in a hard sort of way that jagged against his youth. She felt a little shiver inside her, and wished for the thousandth time that the foul old woman had kept her hands strictly on her business, as unpleasant as that business had been. Susan didn't want to look at this handsome stranger and remember Rhea's touch.
"Nay," she said gently, "thank ye again. I recognize your kindness, but I must refuse."
"Then I'll walk along beside, and Rusher will be our chaperone," he said cheerfully. "As far as the edge of town, at least, there'll be no eyes to see and think ill of a perfectly proper young woman and a more or less proper young man. And once there, I'll tip my hat and wish you a very good night."
"I wish you wouldn't, really."
She brushed a hand across her forehead.
"Easy for you to say there are no eyes to see, but sometimes there are eyes even where there shouldn't be, and my position is a little delicate just now."
"I'll walk with you, however," he repeated, and now his face was somber. "These are not good times, Miss Delgado. Here in Magus you are far from the worst of the troubles, but sometimes trouble reaches out." She opened her mouth to protest again, she supposed, perhaps to tell him that Pat Delgado's daughter could take care of herself. And then she thought of the mayor's new men, and the cold way they had run their eyes over her when Thorin's attention had been elsewhere. She had seen those three this very night as she left on her way to the witch's hut. Them she had heard approaching, and in plenty of time for her to leave the road and rest behind a handy pinon tree. She refused to think of it as hiding, exactly. Back toward town they had gone, and she supposed they were drinking at the Traveler's Rest right now, and would continue to until Stanley Ruiz closed the bar. But she had no way of knowing that for sure. They could come back.
"If I can't dissuade you, very well," she said,
sighing with a vexed resignation she didn't really feel.
"But only to the first mailbox, Mrs. Beach's. That marks the edge of town."
He tapped his throat again, and made another of those absurd, enchanting bows, foot stuck out as if he would trip someone, heel planted in the dirt. "Thank ye, Miss Delgado."
"At least he didn't call me Sai," she thought. "That's a start."
2. She thought he'd chatter away like a magpie, in spite of his promise to be silent, because that was what boys did around her. She was not vain of her looks, but she thought she was good-looking, if only because the boys could not shut up or stop shuffling their feet when they were around her. And this one would be full of questions the town boys didn't need to ask. How old was she? Had she always lived in Hambry? Were her parents alive? 50 others, just as boring. But they would all circle in on the same one. Did she have a steady fellow? But Will Dearborn of the Inner Baronies didn't ask her about her schooling or family or friends, the most common way of approaching any romantic rival she had found. Will Dearborn simply walked along beside her, one hand wrapped around Rusher's bridle, looking off east toward the clean sea. They were close enough to it now so that the teary smell of salt mingled with the tarry stench of oil, even though the wind was from the south. They were passing Sitgo now, and she was glad for Will Dearborn's presence, even if his silence was a little irritating. She had always found the oil patch with its skeletal forest of gantries a little spooky. Most of those steel towers had stopped pumping long since, and there was neither the parts, the need, nor the understanding to repair them. And those which did still labor along, 19 out of about 200, could not be stopped. They just pumped and pumped, the supplies of oil beneath them seemingly inexhaustible. A little was still used, but a very little. Most simply ran back down into the wells beneath the dead pumping stations. The world had moved on, and this place reminded her of a strange mechanical graveyard, where some of the corpses hadn't quite... Something cold and smooth nuzzled the small of her back, and she wasn't quite able to stifle a little shriek. Will Dearborn wheeled toward her, his hands dropping toward his belt. Then he relaxed and smiled. Rusher's way of saying he feels ignored. I'm sorry, Miss Delgado. She looked at the horse. Rusher looked back mildly, then dipped his head, as if to say he was also sorry for having startled her. "Foolishness, girl," she thought, hearing the hearty, no-nonsense voice of her father. "He wants to know why you're being so standoffy, that's all. And so do I. 'Tisn't like you. No, it's not."
"Mr. Dearborn, I've changed my mind," she said. "I'd like to ride."
3. He turned his back and stood looking out at Sitgo with his hands in his pockets, while Susan first laid the poncho over the cantle of the saddle, the plain black saddle of a working cowboy, without a barony brand or even a ranch brand to mark it, and then mounted into the stirrup. She lifted her skirt and glanced around sharply, sure he would be stealing a peek. But his back was still to her. He seemed fascinated with the rusty oil derricks.
"What's so interesting about them, Cully?"
she thought, a trifle crossly. It was the lateness of the hour, and the residue of her stirred-up emotion, she supposed.
"Filthy old things have been there 6 centuries and more, and I've been smelling their stink my whole life."
"Stand easy now, my boy," she said, once she had her foot fixed in the stirrup. One hand held the top of the saddle's pommel, the other the reins. Rusher, meanwhile, flicked his ears, as if to say he would stand easy all night, were that what she required. She swung up, one long bare thigh flashing in the starlight, and felt the exhilaration of being horsed that she always felt. Only tonight it seemed a little stronger, a little sweeter, a little sharper. Perhaps because the horse was such a beauty. Perhaps because the horse was a stranger. Perhaps because the horse's owner is a stranger, she thought, and fair. That was nonsense, of course, and potentially dangerous nonsense. Yet it was also true. He was fair. As she opened the poncho and spread it over her legs, Dearborn began to whistle, and she realized with a mixture of surprise and superstitious fear what the tune was. Careless Love, the very lay she had been singing on her way up to Rhea's hut. "Mayhap it's Ka, girl," her father's voice whispered.
"No such thing," she thought right back at him. "I'll not see Ka in every passing wind and shadow, like the old ladies who gather in Green Heart of a summer's evening. It's an old tune, everyone knows it."
"Mayhap better if you're right," Pat Delgado's voice returned. "For if it's Ka, it'll come like a wind, and your plans will stand before it no more than my dad's barn stood before the cyclone when it came."
Not Ka. She would not be seduced by the dark and the shadows and the grim shapes of the oil derricks into believing it was. Not Ka, but only a chance meeting with a nice young man on the lonely road back to town. "I've made myself decent," she said in a dry voice that didn't sound much like her own. "You may turn back if you like, Mr. Dearborn."
He did turn and gazed at her. For a moment he said nothing, but she could see the look in his eyes well enough to know that he found her fair as well. And although this disquieted her, perhaps because of what he'd been whistling, she was also glad. Then he said, "You look well up there. You sit well." "And I shall have horses of my own to sit before long," she said. "Now the questions will come," she thought. But he only nodded, as though he had known this about her already, and began to walk toward town again. Feeling a little disappointed, and not knowing exactly why, she clucked sidemouth at Rusher and twitched her knees at him. He got moving, catching up with his master, who gave Rusher's muzzle a companionable little caress. "What do they call that place yonder?" he asked, pointing at the derricks.
"The oil patch? Sitgo."
"Some of the derricks still pump?"
"Aye, and no way to stop them. Not that anyone still knows."
"Oh," he said. And that was all, just oh. But he left his place by Rusher's head for a moment when they came to the weedy track leading into Sitgo, walking across to look at the old disused guard hut. In her childhood there had been a sign on it reading "Authorized Personnel Only," but it had blown away in some windstorm or other. Will Dearborn had his look, and then came ambling back to the horse, boots puffing up summer dust, easy in his new clothes. They went toward town, a young walking man in a flat-crowned hat, a young riding woman with a poncho spread over her lap and legs. The starlight rained down on them, as it has on young men and women since time's first hour, and once she looked up and saw a meteor flash overhead, a brief and brilliant orange streak across the vault of heaven. Susan thought to wish on it, and then, with something like panic, realized she had no idea what to wish for. None at all. 4. She kept her own silence until they were a mile or so from town, and then asked the question which had been on her mind. She had planned to ask hers after he had begun asking his, and it irked her to be the one to break the silence, but in the end her curiosity was too much.
"Where do you come from, Mr. Dearborn? And what brings you to our little bit of mid-world, if you don't mind me asking?"
"Not at all," he said, looking up at her with a smile. "I'm glad to talk, and was only trying to think how to begin. Talk's not a specialty of mine."
"Then what is Will Dearborn?" she wondered. Yeah, she wondered very much, for in adjusting her position on the saddle, she had put her hand on the rolled blanket behind, and had touched something hidden inside that blanket, something that felt like a gun. It didn't have to be, of course, but she remembered the way his hands had dropped instinctively toward his belt when she had cried out in surprise.
"I come from the in-world. I've an idea you probably guessed that much on your own. We have our own way of talking."
"Aye. Which barony is your home, might I ask?"
"New Canaan." She felt a flash of real excitement at that. New Canaan, center of the affiliation. That did not mean all at once had, of course, but still.
"Not Gilead?"
she asked, detesting the hint of a girlish gush she heard in her voice. And more than just a hint, mayhap. "No," he said with a laugh, "nothing so grand as Gilead. Only Hemp Hill, a village 40 or so wheels west of there, smaller than Hambry, I wot."
"Wheels," she thought, marveling at the archaism. "He said wheels. And what brings you to Hambry, then? May you tell?"
"Why not? I've come with two of my friends, Mr. Richard Stockworth of Pendleton, New Canaan, and Mr. Arthur Heath, a hilarious young man who actually does come from Gilead. We're here at the Order of the Affiliation, and have come as counters."
"Counters of what?"
"Counters of anything and everything which may aid the affiliation in the coming years," he said, and she heard no lightness in his voice now. "The business with the good man has grown serious."
"Has it? We hear little real news this far to the south and east of the hub."
He nodded. "The barony's distance from the hub is the chief reason we're here. Magus has been ever loyal to the affiliation, and if supplies need to be drawn from this part of the outers, they'll be sent. The question that needs answering is how much the affiliation can count on."
"How much of what?"
"Yes," he agreed, as if she'd made a statement instead of asking a question. "And how much of what?"
"You speak as though the good man were a real threat. He's just a bandit, surely, frosting his thefts and murders with talk of democracy and equality."
Dearborn shrugged, and she thought for a moment that would be his only comment on the matter. But then he said reluctantly, "'Twas once so, perhaps. Times have changed. At some point the bandit became a general, and now the general would become a ruler in the name of the people." He paused, then added gravely, "The northern and western baronies are in flames, lady."
"But those are thousands of miles away, surely."
This talk was upsetting, and yet strangely exciting, too. Mostly it seemed exotic, after the pokey, all-days-the-same world of Hambry, where someone's dry well was good for 3 days of animated conversation. "Yes," he said. "Not I, but yes, the sound was both strange and pleasing to her ear. But the wind is blowing in this direction." He turned to her and smiled. Once more it softened his hard, good looks, and made him seem no more than a child, up too late after his bedtime. "But I don't think we'll see John Farson tonight. Do you?" She smiled back.
"If we did, Mr. Dearborn, would you protect me from him?"
"No doubt," he said, still smiling. "But I should do so with greater enthusiasm, I wot, if you were to let me call you by the name your father gave you."
"Then, in the interest of my own safety, you may do so. And I suppose I must call you Will, in those same interests."
"'Tis both wise and prettily put," he said, the smile becoming a grin, wide and engaging. "I," then, walking as he was with his face turned back and up to her, Susan's new friend tripped over a rock jutting out of the road and almost fell. Rusher whinnied through his nose and reared a little. Susan laughed merrily. The poncho shifted, revealing one bare leg, and she took a moment before putting matters right again. She liked him. Aye, so she did. And what harm could there be in it? He was only a boy, after all. When he smiled, she could see he was only a year or two removed from jumping in haystacks. The thought that she had recently graduated from haystack jumping herself had somehow fled her mind. "I'm usually not clumsy," he said. "I hope I didn't startle you."
"Not at all, Will. Boys have been stubbing their toes around me ever since I grew my breasts." "Not at all," she said, and returned to the previous topic. It interested her greatly. "So ye and your friends come at the behest of the affiliation to count our goods, do you?"
"Yes. The reason I took particular note of yon oil patch is because one of us will have to come back and count the working derricks."
"I can spare you that, Will. There are 19.
He nodded. "I'm in your debt. But we'll also need to make out, if we can, how much oil those 19 pumps are bringing up."
"Are there so many oil-fired machines still working in New Canaan that such news matters? And do you have the alchemy to change the oil into the stuff your machines can use?"
"It's called refinery, rather than alchemy in this case, at least I think so, and I believe there is one that still works. But no, we haven't that many machines, although there are still a few working filament lights in the great hall at Gilead."
"Fancy it," she said, delighted. She had seen pictures of filament lights and electric flambeau, but never the lights themselves.
The last ones in Hambry, they had been called spark lights in this part of the world, but she felt sure they were the same, had burned out 2 generations ago. "You said your father managed the mayor's horses until his death," Will Dearborn said. "Was his name Patrick Delgado? It was, wasn't it?" She looked down at him, badly startled and brought back to reality in an instant.
"How do you know that?"
"His name was in our lessons of calling. We're to count cattle, sheep, pigs, oxen, and horses. Of all your livestock, horses are the most important. Patrick Delgado was the man we were to see in that regard. I'm sorry to hear he's come to the clearing at the end of the path, Susan. Will you accept my condolence?"
"Aye, and with thanks."
"Was it an accident?"
"Aye."
Hoping her voice said what she wanted it to say, which was leave this subject, ask no more.
"Let me be honest with you," he said, and for the first time she thought she heard a false note there. Perhaps it was only her imagination.
Certainly she had little experience of the world. Aunt Cord reminded her of this almost daily. But she had an idea that people who sat on by saying, "Let me be honest with you," were apt to go on by telling you straight-faced that rain fell up, money grew on trees, and babies were brought by the Grand Featherex.
"I will, Dearborn," she said, her tone just the tiniest bit dry. "They say honesty's the best policy, so they do."
He looked at her a bit doubtfully, and then his smile shone out again.
That smile was dangerous, she thought. A quicksand smile, if ever there was one. Easy to wander in, perhaps more difficult to wander back out. There's not much affiliation in the affiliation these days. That's part of the reason Farson's gone on as long as he has. That's what has allowed his ambitions to grow. He's come a far way from the Harrier who began as a stage robber in Garland and DeSoy, and he'll come farther yet if the affiliation isn't revitalized, maybe all the way to Magus. She couldn't imagine what the good man could possibly want with her own sleepy little town in the barony which lay closest to the clean sea. But she kept silent. In any case, it wasn't really the affiliation that sent us, he said. Not all this way to count cows and oil derricks and hectares of land under cultivation. He paused a moment, looking down the road, as if for more rocks in the way of his boots, and stroking Rusher's nose with absent-minded gentleness. She thought he was embarrassed, perhaps even shamed. We were sent by our fathers. Then she understood. Bad boys, they were, sent out on a make-work quest that wasn't quite exile. She guessed their real job in Hambry might be to rehabilitate their reputations. Well, she thought, it certainly explains the quicksand smile, doesn't it? Wear this one, Susan. He's the sort to burn bridges and upset mail carts, then go on his merry way without a single look back. Not in meanness, but in plain old boy carelessness. That made her think of the old song again, the one she'd been singing, the one he'd been whistling. Our father.